Hey, this is post-production Matthew Marissa. Content warnings for this episode include discussions of domestic abuse, specifically child abuse, and very dark themes related to mental health.
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the web. Computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
So, just to reiterate, so you rented this studio?
Well, I rented a house, but it was really cheap, and I figured this would be a good place to do a studio. It's so far from, like, the highway that there's gonna be no traffic sounds. I haven't even heard any, like, bird sounds, so that's pretty quiet.
Yeah.
We don't even need to get, like, egg cartons for insulation. Our soundproofing is just the house.
Yeah, the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding is soundless.
All right, let me just get out this key here. Where is it? Where is it in my pocket? There it is.
Oh, that's a really big key for... I suppose that this door is very much like the door from Super Mario 2.
Yeah, it is very much like exactly the door from Super Mario 2. Actually, I believe the previous owner was Shigeru Miyamoto's grandson's nephew.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I hear he's a big Super Mario 2 fan.
Yeah, alright. All right. Let's go inside.
Greetings, everyone! Would you like to play a game?
Oh, my head. Hang on, I can't play any games right now. I've got this massive headache.
That's because I've trapped you here, and the only way out is to play my game.
Hang on, wait, doesn't that voice sound really familiar?
Yeah, who could that be?
Wait a minute, is that perhaps a long-standing character of ours?
I'm not. My name is Sokobane.
Okay.
And I brought you here to play my game. If you want to escape this house with all your limbs, you must do a theme month without going over the month and without doing any complicated, narrative-driven, cold open storylines.
Oh my god, but...
It's gonna be so hard to do.
Yeah, I don't know if we can do that.
Is there some sort of, like, I don't know, sort of cutting device? Like a cleaver or something?
No cleavers here! No other bladed objects except the totally real guillotines I have situated over your ankles.
Oh, my ankles! No! That'll cut off all the blood to my feet, and I need those to survive.
I mean, I've got diabetes, so, like, I might as well get it over with, you know, early.
Yeah, but I might die.
Oh, right.
And then you won't have a co-host anymore.
Look, just come up with something related to October to talk about. I don't give a shit. Just, you know what? Whatever. It's your funeral.
Well, I guess it would be my funeral. But... I don't know. You know, being trapped in this big, you know, place that was gonna be a studio, this big house just isn't giving me any particularly good ideas.
Yeah, this big house with like nothing inside of it.
Yeah.
Not even like a window or door or wiring or plumbing or a toilet or a sink. I really need to pee, by the way.
Yeah, I also need to pee. It's a shame that this these guillotines are on our ankles, because. I would really like to just shuffle along, but unfortunately, we are in this trap.
Right. Ooh, I've got an idea.
Ooh, okay, hit me.
Mouse trap. Wait, no, that's not scary enough.
Dang it.
Night trap. Wait, nope, still not scary enough.
Trap house? Wait.
Ooh, witch house?
Witch house?
Witch house, Banjo-Kazooie, witchy world, what's her name, Gruntilda? Gruntilda, Grunty's lair... Click clock wood tree, tree with leaves, house of leaves.
House of leaves! Oh my goodness, you're a genius!
Yes. So, I guess let's start on this. So House of Leaves is something that's gonna be very hard to talk about.
It sure is. Would you like to not talk about it for a minute?
Sure.
Because I would like to introduce a new segment.
Oh, we're starting a new segment. Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah, we're starting a new segment. I'm doing this specifically as a middle finger to whoever trapped us. I'm still not entirely certain.
Yeah, I think they said Sokobane?
Sokobane, which is a very good name, and would be very funny if there was like a Bane-like character that we had on this podcast
before.
Yeah,
it's very puzzling.
It's Sorry, that was good. So I would like to introduce a new segment, the Hyperfixation Station.
Toot, toot.
All right, so I am going to be bringing up a particular hyperfixation of mine in this theme month that we have just now decided, because it has to do with houses.
Ooh, houses.
And it has to do with haunted houses.
Haunted houses,
and it has to do with haunting horror games. Internet horror? It's called Anatomy. So, Anatomy by Kitty Horror Show. Kitty Horror Show is, of course, a horror game author. Got a little bit more popular recently. There's been a recent video by Sagan Hawks about her work. And, of course, Jacob Geller did at least two videos, one over Anatomy. I believe it was, like, two over Anatomy. He's brought up Anatomy at least twice, but then he made another video about a bunch of other of Kitty Horror Show's works. Here's the pitch on Anatomy. Anatomy is a game where you open it, and it's essentially a Slender-like. I hate describing it like that, but it kind of is.
It's a walking sim.
It's a walking sim.
A spooky walking sim.
You go, you are in a house that has all of the lights off, and it's you know, dark, spooky, and you find little tapes, and you bring the tapes back to a tape player, and the tape player essentially plays this, like, essay, which is also going to be relevant. But it plays this essay that's essentially describing a house as though we describe a body. Anatomy, like you do. It, you know, goes through these whole things. Every time you finish one tape, it tells you there's a tape in another room, in the kitchen, in the bedroom, what have you. One of the best moments in your first run is that it the author or the speaker describes the basement as, like, you know, like the deep subconscious, I believe, the dark place that nobody wants to dwell on long. And then the very next tape is, there's a tape in the basement, which is always very fun. I love it. But, so you find them, you get a really, really interesting, really compelling little essay, and then the game crashes. Or, you know, closes itself, rather. And then if you open it again, as should always be your case with these kinds of internet horror games, you get a different, a slightly different house, where it starts degenerating. It starts having a lot of, like, Z-fighting textures, there are props out of place, the actual narrations themselves end up, like, skipping and, you know, rewinding and all this kind of, again, degeneration. It's like, the house is deteriorating. There's a couple of notable, like, scares, I won't get too deep into it, but to spoil it, so, you know, little spoilers, skip this part if you don't want to hear the twist here. The twist ultimately ends up being that rather than this house being haunted by something, the house itself is alive and is angry. And it ends up, there's a slightly random element, I believe the part that's like post-gameplay but pre the very ending is slightly randomized. And the very ending, the voice laments that what is... Essentially, it asks the question of, like, what must a house feel when it is lost and abandoned? Like, what we as humans construct a house, put so much faith in it, breathe it to life, so to speak, and then if a house just ends up abandoned, would it not end up resenting us? It's something very...
How Shinto?
Yeah, honestly, yeah. It's a very interesting philosophical angle where it's like, of course, in reality, houses are at the very least not conscious the way that we are. But like, it's something that I think about a lot in the sense of like the irresponsibility of man. You know, how quick man would be to build something and then sooner abandon it for our own purpose.
Yeah, it's using animism to draw into question the way you treat inanimate objects. In this case, a place of living.
Yeah.
A living place.
A living place.
The living room.
Yeah, it's an excellent, excellent game. I highly suggest you look up a video of it or play it yourself. Wonderful game. Love it a lot. I'm going to be drawing parallels at least a couple of times with today's topic and the future topics.
Yeah.
Speaking of today's topic...
Yeah, so House of Leaves. House of Leaves is something I absolutely love. It's my favorite book of all time.
It's not hard to see why. It's an incredible book.
It's also so hard to talk about. We are inevitably not going to cover a lot of things in this episode. I'm going to later on release my notes as footnotes to the book in peak House of Leaves fashion. So this will have an extended addendum, which is really fun to say, to the episode. The episode itself will have footnotes, which in turn are notes on House of Leaves. Don't know when that'll be. It's whenever I'm done reading the book this time, because I'm going through it. It's great. So first we have to talk about Mark C. Danielewski. And this is where we go to the fact corner. Which is what I would say if our legs weren't currently shackled.
Yeah, unfortunately we can't move to the corner, so we're just going to have to kind of like... here, I'm just going to... Okay, cool. I've drawn us a little chalk corner, so we can, you know, put all the facts here.
Okay, yeah. So, Mark C. Danielewski is a really prolific author who... I don't even really know where to begin. Like, essentially, he got his start working as an assistant to a documentarian making a documentary on the philosopher and critic Jacques Derrida, who is mentioned a lot throughout this book. After that, he sort of went on to write the manuscript for this book, House of Leaves. Apparently, like, when he submitted the manuscript finalized, he himself went to the offices of the publisher to manually typeset everything, which is very important for this book for reasons we'll get into.
Yes.
Since then, he's become a huge figure in the world of sort of, like, experimental literature. They call it ergodic literature, literature that uses the physicality of the book in, like, things like page composition and font and stuff like that to add to the story, rather than just being words in order on the book.
Yeah. He's I believe, also generally brought up in the same breath as a lot of postmodern authors, although not for the same effect.
Definitely compared often to Pynchon and Wallace, especially Infinite Jest, which has a similar premise with using footnotes.
Yes.
Of course, Danielewski goes even beyond that.
To make a good book? Yeah. Sorry. I have to.
Yeah. Danielewski is sort of indicative of the transfer from postmodernism to metamodernism, I feel. In a lot of ways, sort of the characters reacting to the story by using genre savviness is something that kind of pops up in House of Leaves.
Yep.
This book is also very heavily based around horror movies, specifically found footage horror like The Blair Witch Project.
And with special note to Haunting of Hill House.
Yes.
Which is a book, I suppose, but was also a movie, a rather classic movie.
Yeah. And in fact, all of Danielewski's novels relate to a different medium. House of Leaves is about film. His second novel, Only Revolutions, is about music. That one's a novel that has two looping storylines, where when you finish one, you flip the book over and read it backwards, a la a record.
Yep.
You spin it around, flip it, you know, side B. And then his third novel, which is a serialized one called The Familiar, which is based off of television, specifically prestige television, a la something like The Wire. The Familiar was written, I think, around the time of, like, Game of Thrones and Walking Dead's popularity and peak.
Yep.
So that one, however, was not finished. He planned a certain number of volumes, and I believe due to low sales, his publisher said, like, hey, you can't do this, man. Which just sucks, but, you know.
That's unfortunate, but, yeah. You know, sometimes that's the life when in serialized television.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty fitting. And then he also has written some novellas, most notably The 50-Year Sword, which is just sort of another horror novella. Really good one. I read it in, like, a day while standing at the library. Not even in a day, like, in an hour. It's great.
Nice.
And then he has also recently went on to write children's books, such as The Little Blue Kite, which use a lot of his sort of Danielewski-isms to create a book that is, like, hopefully, I guess the idea is that it is fun for kids to read the words as, like, images, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's imaginative.
Yeah, it's imaginative. If I was a kid, I probably would have loved it and all the weird things it does with letters. So that's an overview of Danielewski's career. It's also worth noting that his sister, who he is very close with, is a musician by the name of Poe. And just keep that in mind.
Gotcha.
That's her, like, you know, stage name. Mark C. Danielewski, by the way, has a very dedicated forum community and he has a group he calls his ateliers that they're like research assistants slash cultural consultants. Very, very interesting sort of, he does his research.
Yeah.
Now, House of Leaves.
So House of Leaves.
House of Leaves, let's start at the outside. House of Leaves is a book about Johnny Truant, who is this asshole whose friend calls him in like the middle of the night, like 3 a.m, and is like, hey, this guy in my apartment complex died. So Johnny goes over to his friend Lude, his apartment complex, and goes into the apartment of one now deceased Zampano. Zampano died due to mysterious circumstances. All the windows and doors were like bolted shut and covered. And the man was blind and seemingly just very mysterious.
Yeah, he didn't just die due to mysterious circumstances. He lived due to mysterious circumstances as well. There's a lot of not conflicting, but like vague information given about Zampano himself. One of the early reveal essentially is that the process of the book itself is putting together this gigantic manuscript that Zampano had been working on for God knows how long. But the fact that he is blind is held on, like, Johnny holds off on that fact for a little bit until after he sort of mentions, like, just how goddamn much there has been written about it.
Right. So this manuscript was found in fragments of various pieces of paper of different kinds in a trunk in Zampano's house. A trunk that Johnny takes home with him to piece through. And these are all scramblings that Johnny finds are manuscripts of a critical analysis of a movie called The Navidson Record. Now here's the thing. The Navidson Record is a movie about a guy named Will Navidson, who is a like Pulitzer-winning photojournalist, who with his unmarried spouse Karen Green and their children Chad and Daisy move into a house on Ashtree Lane, and weird things start happening.
Yes. So if you have gotten a pitch for this book before, or if you have heard a pitch for this book before, the pitch might go something like this. The main character, which, gigantic fucking asterisk there, but the main character ends up one day realizing that the inside of his house is a quarter of an inch bigger than the outside.
Right. What happens first is a closet appears between the parents' bedroom and the kids' bedroom.
Yes.
Then he measures the length of the inside, and like you said, it's a quarter inch larger.
Yes.
He double checks the floor plans, because he's like, where did this closet come from? And that's when he gets the idea to measure it. And thinking his tools are weird, he calls up his friend Billy Reston, who is a retired engineer who teaches at, I believe, Harvard. And Billy Reston was a friend that Navidson made due to a photography, like, a trip that Navidson took to be a journalist.
Yes, although I believe first he calls Tom.
Right, one of them, yeah, he calls Tom, which is his brother.
Yeah, Tom Navidson.
Yeah, Tom Navidson has been kind of, not really estranged, but distant. But Tom takes this excuse to drive down and hang out and measure. And then, yeah, after that, they call Billy Reston. Reston comes in. Reston is, by the way, handicapped. He is paraplegic.
Yes.
So
he
uses a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
But he gets out some big gun measuring tools, and they're like, no, it's not a quarter of an inch. It's more than that.
Yeah, it's like it's 5/16 of an inch.
Yeah, it gets seemingly bigger. And during this, something weird happens. Karen was busy making a bookshelf that sat against the wall, and the bookshelf, some of the books fell over because the gap between the bookshelf and the wall widened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a really, really well-written bit that I just want to emphasize a little, because it's like, it mentions the first time that, like, you know, somebody takes a book off and the books go dominoing down and they eventually hit the side of the wall. Mm-hmm. And it brings up the bookshelf later at the, like, near the very end, where Tom is like, he picks up a book to try and wedge a door open that's in the weird closet that they don't understand. And it does the domino thing again, except this time without anybody having moved it, a book falls off on the side, and Karen screams.
Yeah, because she realizes what just happened. So, they're kind of very perplexed for a moment when a door appears in their living room. Now, the wall that the door appears on is actually brought into question, whether it's the north or the west wall, so there's something to think about. But the door opens into a long, pitch-black hallway with, like, absolutely nothing inside. There's an entire long-ass set of footnotes about the amount of things that are not in this hallway. It's like the entirety of the hardware store bridge times two. That's what you can imagine. There's just nothing. It's just pitch black. Navidson tries to go inside, turns around really quickly. It's freezing in there. And he is desperate to explore it. Karen really does not want him to. So they compromise. They compromise and they agree to call someone. But later that night, Navidson goes in anyways.
Yeah, he has like a restless night, and at 3:19 a.m., a title card pops up, Exploration Number One.
Yeah. It's worth noting, by the way, that so the reason all these other scenes are in the film is that Navidson, being a photojournalist, wanted to make a video, sort of like a vlog almost, about their new house they moved into. So he put cameras on all the like ceilings and walls, like a reality show.
Yeah,
with the idea being that he was going to show, you know, a life for a typical American family.
Yeah, that's one thing worth noting is that like the reason that within the fiction, without getting into any of the other layers, in the fiction of the book, this is a movie that was meant to essentially be like him exploring his life, like trying to get away from all the press, get away from all the high life, and finally settle down, raise the family that he has. And then all of this fucky shit starts happening.
Yeah. So Exploration Number One, he goes down the hallway, turns a bit, goes down the hallway, and there's a door. He opens the door and it's a hallway with more doors. And this proceeds for a while of him going through different doors. Eventually, he comes to a very big room, almost gets lost, uses the sound of his voice to find an echo to go back, and is able to find his way home. He doesn't bring this up to Karen, and pretty soon comes the help that him and Billy and Tom called. We have Holloway Roberts, who is a, like, adventure exploration guy. Like, he is the most... He's like Clayton from Tarzan. He's not necessarily a hunter, though he does have a hunting rifle. He is just like a thrill seeker bent on doing dangerous things in nature.
Yeah, he's a Teddy Roosevelt-esque.
Yeah, there's also Jed, who is a lover of the outdoors, a camping guy, and there is Wax, who is a rock climber. Like a free base rock climber.
Which is definitely going to help him in this big impossible house.
Well, they're all like survivalist type people that all knew each other.
True.
They're an adventuring crew. And with them in the place, they're able to start taking more explorations. Exploration 2 and 3, not a whole lot else happens other than they find a staircase in the big room that Navidson was in. A spiral staircase going down. And they can't find a bottom to it. They also start to run out of supplies. It's getting really cold, so they make a retreat and decide to stock up for a much longer expedition. This is where shit hits the fan.
Oh, fuck. Oh, boy. Oh, bother.
Exploration number 4 is where Holloway, Jed, and Wax go down, and they lose radio contact with, like, the command post in the living room. And we get moments from both the perspective of those three and the perspective of the other group because, so Jed, Wax, and Holloway, they find what seems to be not the bottom of the stairwell, but they find a lot of rooms branching off of it, but they get separated. Now, there is a growl that characters hear in the house, in the hallways, this dark area. The 5.5 minute hallway, which is the name of the first hallway that appeared and everything afterwards.
In the fiction, it's a short film that released before the Davidson
Yeah, record. It was like a viral movie.
Yeah.
Copied by VHS, like the South Park pilot.
Yeah.
Which was great. I'll talk about that in a bit. So they get split off. They hear the growl. Holloway is convinced that this is something trying to kill him. And so he runs off to try and hunt down whatever is following them. Jed and Wax are lost, and they get shot. Wax gets shot specifically in the arm. And he gets shot by Holloway, because Holloway thought that Wax was some monster in the darkness. And it's like, dude, come on, just help him.
Yeah.
And Holloway's like, no, I don't want to go to jail. I'm going to have to kill him and kill you. And Jed's like, no, dude, I'm not going to report you to the police. It was an accident. So they try to carry Wax up a makeshift stretcher, and Holloway disappears. And so Jed calls for help with an SOS. Three knocks, three long knocks, three knocks. Somehow, I believe, Chad hears this, like, in the living room.
Yeah.
Which is miles away, by the way. And Davidson, Billy Reston, and Tom all decide to go in to try to help them. So all three of them go in. By the way, during this, they have both been using fishing line as, like, an Ariadne's thread, and that gets cut. And also, they have been using reflective paint that gets smudged and chipped off the walls to try to mark where they went. Additionally, as Holloway's group was going down the staircase, they were leaving, like, supply drops behind so that they would have refueling stations as they go back up. And those got damaged and ruined. Like, the water was destroyed, the food was gone.
Huh.
Yeah. So, when the rescue crew comes in, they find the staircase. Tom sets up camp at the top, and Reston and Davidson decide to descend the staircase, which they find to be very shallow. As they're exploring, they're able to hear some cries for help, and they find Jed. But right as they find Jed, literally in the span of two frames of the movie, according to the book, Jed is shot in the head by Holloway.
Oh.
Reston tries returning fire, but nothing really happens, and they scramble out, trying to just carry Jed and Wax away. So Jed dies. Wax is in pretty bad condition. He has, like, an infection, but he's still alive. They are able to create a, like, pulley system to raise Wax's stretcher up, as well as raise Reston. They do that, and then Will Davidson is about to, like, get onto it when the stairway stretches. It grows.
Oh.
And the rope snaps. So he's stuck down there for a while.
Ooh.
Reston, Tom, and Wax get out of there, as well as with Jed's body. And then, like, there's a police investigation, and there's a bit where the sheriff is like, fine, I'll take a look in here. And then he, like, steps once into the hallway, turns around, leaves, and is like, thoroughly investigated the house. No sign of suspect. Yeah, the police were useless.
Yeah, glad to hear that hasn't changed since 2000.
Yeah. And it seems like Davidson is gone as well, but he is somehow able to make it back thanks to hearing the sound of Daisy calling for him. And at that point, they decide, let's move out. But the house doesn't like that.
Ooh.
As they're packing up and leaving, Tom barricades the doorway to the hallway, which, by the way, he created colored keys for, like red, blue, green, and yellow keys. And I love to think of that as like Doom keys.
Yeah.
Like, it's so video gamey. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. For reference, he barricaded, I believe, like one of the things that Tom does after they contact, before they contact the exploration crew, but after they end up contacting the other guy,
Reston,
is like he literally, you know, bolts, like, replaces the door with like a door that has those four keys, because dear God, we don't want anybody opening this door.
Yeah. So yeah, as they're getting ready to leave, he barricades it with like furniture and gives the keys to Karen, who just throws them away, essentially, because Karen doesn't want anyone going back in there. But as they're moving, the house starts to, like, shift. The rooms become black. By the way, during all this, Karen's been trying out, like, feng shui. She bought a lot of, like, decorative stuff, like dragon statues and turtles.
Yep.
All those disappear between Davidson leaving and coming back from Exploration 4. all of those are gone. And so the house, like, it turns black. It almost crushes Karen while she's in, like, their bedroom. She is able to get out safely, thanks to Navidson. Tom rescues Daisy, and Chad, who had been kind of very distant and having a hard time at school and getting into fights and stuff and spending time outside, was already outside. Reston almost falls because the floor under where the barricade was gives way. Navidson almost falls because the stairs become a slide, and he almost slides down into that pit. But he's able to save himself and Reston. He gets Reston out. As Tom is able to get Daisy out the window, Tom finds himself unable to move. Because the moment he takes a step, the house moves him back.
Ah.
This is, I think, one of the most key parts of the house having agency. It's, like, very clearly toying with Tom. Navidson tries to crawl through to save Tom. The house, as Navidson is coming in, shuts the window. Like, makes it just blam, and cuts Tom's fingers.
Yeah.
And then suddenly the floor drops out from under Tom, and he is gone. Navidson is able to escape, however, but he is just distraught because Tom is dead.
Yeah.
At this point, Karen makes a preliminary version of the movie and sends it to a bunch of people and gets a lot of thoughts. Essentially, like, Navidson handed her a box of all the footage and was like, do something with this. Meanwhile, during the expeditions, the crews got shavings from the wall, like wood shavings almost. And at Harvard or MIT or wherever Reston teaches at, he was able to pull some strings and get these analyzed in a lab. Some of the samples date to like 100 years ago, and then some of them date to like thousands of years ago, and then some of them date to before the universe. The exact specifics are completely crossed out and just like you can't see it, but it's pretty clearly like hinted that it's that old.
Yeah.
Additionally, then I believe a bit later, all the people that were involved with this start having strange symptoms and unexplained phenomena. Eventually, Navidson decides that he must go back into the house. He returns. The moment he steps inside the house, everyone's symptoms disappear.
Ah.
He does one more expedition in, I believe, what is known as Escape? So the book doesn't have chapter titles, but it also does have chapter titles.
Yeah, all of the chapters in this book are essentially just Roman numerals, but at the very end, there's a... at the end of the book, there is a...
Appendix.
Appendix is the word.
That has a bunch of shit.
It has so much shit. And one of those things is what Zampano was theoretically going to call all of these chapters, which is really funny that they just don't use them as the chapter names, because, like... There's no, like, I'm fairly certain there's two different things, and there's no contradiction between either, so they could easily work.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Anyways, yeah, so this one is The Return, is what it's called. It's Navidson's return to the house. So, he goes there, the house, like, directly seems to be trying to harm him. He has, like, a bicycle and a cart filled with food and water, but those disappear due to a similar, like, slippery sliding slope. He crawls through a tiny, 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 tiny space, and he ends up on, like, a plateau in the middle of a void. And the floor eventually gives way, so he's just, like, falling seemingly infinitely. The only things he has left on him are a box of matches and the only book he has, House of Leaves. Don't think about it.
Yeah, you might be tempted to go, wait, isn't that the book that we are currently reading? Don't think about it.
Don't think about it. So... It seems like he's gone, but when Karen goes to the house to try to, like, follow after him, the house suddenly dissolves, according to what she said. They find themselves in the middle of the world. Not the world, but, like, back to normal. Just outside. There's no house anymore. And they cry and hug each other. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the Navidson record. There's a lot more to go into that, but for now, I want to go outward a bit more, because we had to talk about Zampano.
All right, yeah, layer two.
So, all of this is a movie in-universe. However, Johnny, like, he can't find any evidence of the movie ever existing. There's, like, quotes from Stephen King and Hofstadter and like all of these famous people in it that just do not know what the fuck he's talking about.
Yeah, there's quotes from a bunch of famous people. There's also part of the construction of this is that like the manuscript itself has a ton of like cited sources.
Yeah,
and like a lot of these are sources that specifically are like critical analyses and readings of this book or right. of this movie.
Yeah, he references like so-and-so published an article about this book or about this movie. It's great. Some of those sources are real and you can read them and look them up. Some of them do not exist. Some of them are people who are credited who were real people but not for the right profession.
Yes.
Which is funny. And then of course there's like doubts about Zampano. Not only does this movie not seem to exist, but, like, he would have had to have so much dictated to him to talk about things like shot composition, which is a very frequent subject.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that he can't, like, somebody could have said, like, you know, oh, it's arranged this way, but he's never really given any indication that that's the case.
Yeah, that's one of the key things, the key big question marks, is, like, there are multiple times where Johnny will talk about how he actually gets in contact with people who, like, dictated things to him.
Right.
Who would read to him.
Yeah, so Zampano would invite women over to read to him and then have them write things down, most of which were things in the Navidson Record manuscript.
Yeah, and it's like, it's on one hand, it's a fun little characterization of him, of course. He's kind of a dirty old man. I don't believe there's any references to him doing anything untoward, but, you know, he likes women reading to him. But at the same time, it's like, I mean, like you said, there are so many very granular details about, like, not just, you know, oh, the walls are black. Like, you know, if I were somebody dictating to somebody who couldn't see, like, it's, there are very specific references on, like, specific cuts. Like, it's not impossible to write something like this without seeing it, but it's very, very difficult, especially if you're going through, like, an entire book's worth of people that you are dictating to.
Yeah. Also, like, having it done by word of mouth, having those people have, like, specific things they notice. Like, there's a bowl of pistachios mentioned. I don't know if I would have known it was a bowl of pistachios. If somebody showed me a picture of a bowl of pistachios and I was trying to explain it to somebody else, I would probably just say a bowl of nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Try this out at home. You'll see it. So Zampano has a lot of questions around him. Also, there's things like he didn't really hang out with people. He had a bunch of stray cats that followed him in the courtyard of the building, but he didn't really get out much. There's a lot of weird stuff around him and in his identity. And so we get a lot of backstory for Will Navidson, and we get a lot of backstory for Johnny Truant, but Zampano is much less forthcoming about his backstory. I'll talk about that a bit later, but just keep that in mind. So Johnny Truant, then.
Johnny Truant is one of the best goddamn protagonists in any writing.
Yeah, so now we can talk about the structure of the novel. So the Navidson Record manuscript is the main body of the text. This is written in Times New Roman, and anything that Zampano writes is written in Times New Roman. The Navidson Record, Times New Roman. Fuck, I just noticed that. All the font choices are intentional.
Yes.
So Johnny writes in the footnotes. Sometimes there are footnotes that are Zampano's writings that are like the cited sources or just other addendums to add. Johnny has his own footnotes. Sometimes it's about what Zampano had written directly down. Sometimes it's about like sources and like people he contacted or translations that Zampano didn't provide. Most of the time, it's him fucking blogging.
Yeah, it's a lot of him essentially talking about his life in these specific moments as he is piecing this manuscript together. A lot of it is very, when you get to, I won't even say later chapters, just like chapter 3 and 4, it gets very run-on sentence-y.
Yeah.
Like, his life is being torn fucking asunder by this manuscript.
Yeah, so most of it is he and his friend Lude going to bars in hitting on women, and usually it ends with Johnny having some sort of sex.
Yes.
Some sort of sexual encounter. Except then we also learn he works at a tattoo shop, and he hates his boss there, but he's really good at doing, like, the menial setup tasks, so his boss keeps him around. He eventually, though, like, starts having panic attacks. he goes into, like, the storeroom of the tattoo shop, and he feels like he tastes blood. He feels like something's breathing down his neck. His vision gets, like vignetted. And he has panic attacks. He has, you know, delusions, paranoia. It gets worse over time. He has more sex. And eventually it gets so bad that he just, like, doesn't leave the house that often. He starts bolting down the windows and doors and kind of just doing the same thing Zampano did. And eventually he finishes the damn manuscript. There's this whole thing with, like, Lude introduces him to this German girl whose boyfriend or her fiancé is on, like, a military leave. And so Johnny has sex with her, but then the boyfriend comes back and is pissed, and he kills Lude. But Lude might not be dead, because Johnny lies about things constantly. He admits to editing stuff in the Navidson record just because.
Yeah.
And there's this whole part where he goes on a diary tangent for days about him, like, eventually getting help from a doctor that's a friend of his. And then he's like, you really believe that? I made that shit up. Everything from this page onward, I just made up. And one of those things was Lude dying, but then he writes again, Lude died. And it's like, bro, stop. And then there's something like, I think he ends up killing the boyfriend. It's unclear. It all ends with Johnny submitting the manuscript, going to a concert for, like, a small band, and hearing the band reference the manuscript. And he talks with them, and he's really impressed at how closely they've read the book. It's a really funny way to end Johnny's story.
Yeah.
Except then he's like, I just remembered, or I'm writing down only what I've just remembered. And then it's a story of, like, there's, like, a whole page about a boy who died at birth. So that's fucked up. So Johnny lies. His words, by the way, are written in Courier, because he is the messenger between Zampano.
Yep.
Also, by the way, the editors have their own footnotes, usually, like, commenting on Johnny.
Yeah.
And they're written in Bookman. Bookman.
Bookman.
They're the Bookman. It's pretty great.
Yeah, it's
Johnny has a lot going on. He slowly divulges bits about his past. He's really hesitant to do so, but he slowly does. This is where one of the big content warnings come in that I'm going to add at the start of the episode.
Yes.
So, Johnny, his dad was a pilot who died in a truck crash. However, shortly before that, his mom tried to kill him in a manic state, in a fit of paranoia and mania. So his dad had taken his mom to a psychiatric hospital called the Whalestone Institute. And then his dad died, and Johnny went into foster care. The foster parent he lived with for the longest time, Raymond, beat him. Like, Johnny would get into fights because, you know, he had a lot of problems, and then Raymond would beat him up and call him a beast. Johnny has this thing where, like, almost every guy except Lude is, like, just given these dark animalistic things. He calls them, like, brutes and oafs and beasts and stuff. So he definitely has sort of a self-image problem with this.
Yeah.
And he runs away from that. He is able to get his pilot's license, I believe, and go to Alaska, where he works at a fish cannery. He is invited out to the fishing boat one day, but the boat gets capsized and he almost drowns. However, his friend does drown. Sometime between that and the current day, he moves to LA and starts work as a tattoo artist. Now, his dad's obituary is in the appendix, as well as the Whalestone letters, which are letters written by his mom, Pelafina, to him. These letters are heartbreaking, harrowing. It's dark. They're really, like, a first-person account of someone's sort of descent into paranoia due to not taking their medicine at a psychiatric hospital. She, like, starts to think everyone at the hospital is trying to kill her or hurt her or worse. There's this whole bit where she thinks that there's a new director at the hospital who's out to get her and is, like, hiding her letters before they get mailed, when it's the same director. It's the same guy. And her letters are, like, kind of sus. Like, not great. She mentions, like, that she's as giddy as a schoolgirl, and she talks about, like, I don't know. It sounds weirdly romantic to be writing to your own son like that.
Yeah, it's little sprinkle of Bates.
It's not good. It just gets worse. Yeah, she has a mental breakdown. She thinks that, like, Johnny's not messaging her and hates her when it's been 3 days since her last letter, or even shorter, because the dates of the letters are there. Eventually, she has, like, one final slip back into lucidity and apologizes, and then has another descent, and then the last letter is just the institution's letter to Johnny saying, your mother has passed away. It's really heartbreaking. Again, super, like just awful to read. Really evocative, really well done, I'll say.
Yeah, very well written. Yeah. Not a fun time to read, yeah. But...
it does give a lot of context to Johnny, however. Like... that's sort of a big part of the book, is learning the circumstances of the people involved and how those reflect on the story. Because in many ways, the accounts of the events in the story are strictly reflections of the characters. Or you might say echoes.
Echoes, hello.
Okay, so we've covered the meat. There's a few other things in the appendix worth mentioning. There's a list of poems. There's the Pelican poems, which are separate than the first list of poems. These all mention Mr. Pelican, which is why they're called that. However, when they're referenced in the Navidson record, the letters except for the P are X'd out, and there's one more X than you would need for Pelican. However, there's enough for Pelafina. This also, the P appears a lot. Pelican Black is one of the ink colors that Johnny mentions the tattoo parlor having. There's a story he tells of a Pekingese dog who gets run over, and the like guilt of seeing the Pekingese dog weighs on him heavily. Pekingese, Pelafina, same amount of letters. There's a lot like that.
Mind your P's.
Mind your P's. Now,
fuck the Q's, though.
I mentioned that Johnny lies a lot. He lies a lot about himself as well. Like, not just does he admit to changing the story and he admits to making stuff up for the novel, but he kind of makes himself out to be this, like, real douchey dude bro guy. But, like, the letters that Pelafina sent are littered with references to mythology and multilingual phrases that he would have had to buy dictionaries. And, like, even then, Pelafina's like, I received your letter, your writing is great. And, like, he's very clearly being poetic with a lot of his writing.
Yeah.
He is like a trained writer, very educated, more so than he makes himself out to be. And the fact that he makes up so much is very complicated. Additionally, there are some passages he tries to remove from the book that the editors include themselves.
Yeah. There's one thing about the structure, which we're going to have to get into separately, but one of the things about the structure that makes this such a difficult book to read is that there are passages that are struck out, that were like struck out by Zampano, that Johnny managed to re-earth, essentially. There are passages that Johnny writes that he doesn't want published, that the editors publish anyway. There are also, like, different passages that, like, Johnny or Zampano, like, didn't want that are respected. Like, the amount of missing content in the fiction of House of Leaves probably rivals the amount of content that is there.
Yeah. I love one of the things in the appendix is a list of, it's a set of like examples or exhibits that Zampano wanted to include in the manuscript that just didn't.
Yeah.
So it's like, please include an example of Egyptian architecture. And that's it. That's on the page. I also love the Song of Quesada and Molino missing. An entire page dedicated to this in the appendix, and it's just not there. Yeah, let's go and talk about, like, the actual physical writing of it.
Okay,
because this is one of the big things that House of Leaves is notable for.
So the type of literature that you described...
ergodic literature.
Ergodic. Ergodic. Ergodic literature is fascinating to me, because, as said, like, as described, the physicality of the book is specifically taken into account with it. I think one of the easiest examples, the easiest to wrap your head around, is that there are multiple pages in the halfway point of the book or so that have like about one sentence or, you know, a couple of sentences per page. Mm-hmm. So that like during a tense moment, you are literally flipping through the pages faster.
Right.
Except that just kind of tips the, like, that scratches the tip of the iceberg as far as the things that this book does.
Yeah, we mentioned the footnotes. These start off kind of normal, where, like, a footnote will be on the same page as the pointer in the text. But eventually, like, especially with Johnny's footnotes getting longer, the text and the footnotes will start to outpace each other in different ways. And eventually, like, this kind of comes to a point where there'll be footnotes within footnotes within footnotes, and it all comes to head in Chapter 9, Exploration 4, where footnotes point backward to other pages.
Yeah!
And those footnotes will point to other pages, and so forth. And Exploration 4, Chapter 9, also has, like, the window where Holloway punches a hole in the wall. There is a square in the book that has text in it, and when you flip the page on the other side, it is the backwards version of the text from the previous page.
Yeah, it's mirrored.
Yeah, and then you can keep reading through that hole. It's a hole in the book, and that's the one that has the list of things that aren't in the house.
For a hole in the book or a whole new book, call Shane Company.
Yep, that's definitely a local company. There's also, like, that one has, when they're going down staircases, the text is arranged like a staircase, so that's the path your eyes follow. It has backwards text, it has upside down text, the sides of the pages have text that are their own footnotes, and, like, it becomes really cramped and claustrophobic. There's, like, a tiny, tiny footnote that just says, see footnote blank, like, see footnote 180. That's just in the corner of a page, almost obscured by the crease of the binding. It's so great.
Yeah.
And it just gives this feeling of, like, okay, now I'm in the maze with them. The writing of the novel matches the events of the novel. I kind of call this, like, mechanics. They feel like game mechanics in a way.
Yeah.
So, for this happens a lot. I wanted to mention a few chapters in particular. So, for example, Animals is a chapter that is 2 pages long with 3 pages of endnotes. There are no footnotes, like no dividers, on the first 2 pages. This is the chapter where it is revealed that the animals, the 2 pets that the Navidsons have, a dog and a cat, cannot actually enter the dark part of the house, the 5.5 minute hallway. When they go through the hallway, they end up outside where it would put them normally. And so with the animals not being part of the house, they are not part of the, like, manufactured setup of House of Leaves. They do not have Johnny Truant or Zampano directly with them. They are their own separate thing with a tail instead of footnotes.
Yeah. Which, number one, endnotes as a tale is good. Number two, it's also a very fun chapter because, essentially, the extent of the chapter is more or less talking about this incident and then talking about how there really isn't any literature, despite the fact that this is definitely something interesting and, like, would be interesting to explore.
Yeah.
But, well, they gloss over it in the movie, so, you know, yeah. Pretty much every writing glosses over it too. And then Johnny's fucking footnote is like, yeah, Zampano also glosses over it. This is the only writing I could find about the animals, and that's a shame, because that is a really interesting detail.
Yeah. Another one I wanted to mention is the Holy Tape, aka the Holloway Tape, which was a section that was just Holloway's perspective, where Navidson eventually found Holloway's camera, like, lying on the ground. And the manuscript for this that Johnny has in his hand has holes in it, burnt from some kind of ash. Ash, by the way, is a reoccurring motif, often related to Mount Vesuvius, where Pliny the Lesser said that the eruption looked like an ash tree. Pompeii, close your eyes. But so, in the book, in House of Leaves, these holes are represented by empty brackets. And it's really fun, because, like, some of the brackets you could fill in with context clues, but it just gets to the point where there's so much that you cannot tell. And this is representative because in the fiction of the Navidson record, the movie, this section of the movie is, like, unwatchable. Because Holloway is an angry exploration guy. He is not a photographer or a, like, he doesn't use a video camera. He doesn't know shit about holding it still. So there's like frantic jump cuts and shit. It's like unwatchable garbage. And so it's unreadable to the point where it just has huge holes in it.
Which is, again, very lovely.
And yeah, holy tape, Holloway tape, but with the part in the middle cut out, so it's holy.
Holy.
It's great. It's so good. And then the last one I wanted to mention is the chapter about Tom. There is a chapter that is specifically about the relationship between the two brothers. It compares them to like Jacob and Esau or like the prodigal sons. And that entire chapter has two columns instead of one. You know, if you go into like Microsoft Word and you set it to two columns instead of one.
Yeah.
Like, it has that.
It has paragraph A and paragraph B on the same page.
Yeah. Because it's about the two brothers being linked together,
which is nice.
Yeah. And there's also like, there are moments where different types of media are represented. So like when Karen interviews famous people, that's represented as like an interview transcript. When Tom is at the camp by himself, he has this whole audio log that he leaves with it's just like him telling jokes, and that all is like a transcript of audio. With I don't remember the font for that, but it is a different font, but it's very fun.
Yeah, Tom is a favorite character in this, personally.
Tom is the best character.
Tom is lovely.
Yeah.
Rip Tom.
Yeah. Talking about the characters a bit, just in the Navidson record, Will is kind of, there's a lot of toxic masculinity in this movie, and it's great because this being a satire of academia, Danielewski writes a lot of really apt feminist critiques of his own movie.
Yes.
Yeah. So, like, that's the thing. We talked about how he writes, like, other people's writings about the Navidson record. A lot of them are feminist perspectives, and a lot of them are really good.
Yeah. Like, so, one thing that I really love, there's a couple of moments where he, like, digs into Karen as a, like, he digs into Karen Green as a person, where he's like, it's interesting how much, like, Zampano in the fiction of the Davidson Record manuscript writes about how it's interesting how much, like, critique was labeled at Karen. And, like, Zampano himself essentially notes, like, it's interesting, you know, it's interesting, like, how much of this criticism existed and even came from, like, you know, from, you know, female authors of Karen as, like, this, you know, mindless floozy. And then Zampano specifically stands up for her and is like, except that if you actually watch the thing, you clearly see, no, she's a mother who cares for her children and is upset that her not exactly husband keeps, like, more or less endangering himself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, also there are, like, further things, like how there will be passages from feminist critics who talk about how, like, much of the movie is about men trying to conquer something and one-up each other.
Yeah.
Like, Navidson gets really mad about Holloway going through the hallways because he's, like, you know, interrupting Navidson's space, and this is Navidson's house, not Holloway.
Yeah.
And how Holloway's drive to shoot things is based on a desire to be the best and be famous and hunt a monster in this case. And I love all those. One of the first notes I wrote down about the characters in the Navidson record is that Karen Green is Skylar White.
Yes.
Like, yes. It's wild how fitting, like, Danielewski's perspective on Karen is compared to other female characters, especially Skylar White, because, like, Walter White is a character who endangers his family for his own interests in his own toxic masculine pride. The response in fiction to Karen Green is, like, the same, and it's wild.
Yeah,
it's so prescient.
Yeah, it's we're gonna be talking about this more with themes, but, like, this book really did sort of call a lot of things that would, like, you know, pop off or be very popular nowadays, or, you know, ultimately you could say that the future echoed what it wrote.
Yeah,
hey, do we want to talk about themes?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so here's what I want to start with. Echoes. So chapter 5, is one of maybe the most important chapters in the book. By the way, there is a chapter 5.5. The chapter where Navidson first goes into the hallway is 5.5. There's no header for it, but there is the big capital letter at the start of a chapter in a big blank space where a number would be, but it's between 5 and 6. It's 5.5. It's the 5.5 minute hallway. Okay, so Echo chapter 5 is about Echo, the mythological figure, and Echo, the scientific fact. There is a very common tendency for the book to contrast a fictional thing or an aesthetic thing with a scientific thing. For example, when the passage with the things that aren't in the house is there, there is also a passage about all the movies House of Leaves is not similar to.
Yeah.
So it's like comparing the aesthetics of movies to the factual objective stuff of the of household whatnots. The most like fitting version of this is in Echo, where Zampano talks about the history of the myth of Echo, and then talks about the science behind Echoes. And these are both super important. Echo, the science, he kind of relates it to echolocation specifically.
Which I believe Johnny specifically notes is like, it must have been something really important to him, given that he was fucking blind.
Specifically, Johnny first says that Zampano is blind as a bat, which I think is very fun and fitting.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, but also, that's how Navidson finds his way back out of the hallway the first time he goes in, is he shouts and uses the echo to figure out where the closest wall is. Because Zampano shows, like, a formula for determining echo and notes that, like, if any constant in, like, the volume of the space is infinite, then it ends up being zero. So there's a big sort of, he goes into so much detail scientifically so that when details in the movie are told in the coming chapters, their significance is understood, which makes sense. But then there's Echo, the mythological character. He goes in depth about the, like, multiple myths behind Echo. I love the line of, like, Echo turned down Pan's hand in marriage, and Pan, being the god of infinite wisdom and patience, teared her to shreds immediately.
Yeah!
Like, that was such so a good line. So funny.
Zampano's writing is just great.
Yeah. One version of the story is that she was buried underground in a cave, and the other one was that she wasn't torn to shred, but just died due to falling in love with Narcissus, and, like, being obsessed with him, but being unable to do anything with him.
Yeah.
These are both very important, because the cave is compared to the house, and Narcissus is kind of Johnny and or Zampano and or Will Navidson, especially Will being so interested in his own sort of drive to be a journalist that he loses sight of his wife, Karen.
Yeah.
Karen does not die in the house, by the way, which is very important compared to Echo. Echo, it could be related to the woman reading to Zampano. Their voices are female voices reading whatever text, so they are like Echo talking to Narcissus that way. Also, we mentioned echolocation. There's also a lot of times where there are sort of phrases that might not make sense in the text, but when you say them, they might make sense. There is known some call is air am, which is a Latin phrase that is written in English words in, like, you know, the Japanese phrases.
Yeah,
mean?
It's Romanized, essentially. Yeah.
God, Latin's Japanese. Already Romanized, you idiot.
Fuck. I can't believe this.
And that's similar to echolalia, of, like, saying something after you say it again. But then also, Echo in her, like, there's echoes, like, theoretically between, you know, the characters and the stories, the different stories. Things that happen in Johnny's life also happen in the Navidson record, and so forth. Also, the footnotes could be considered echoes. Like, especially the Echo chapter, chapter 5, is where we start getting footnotes on footnotes.
Yeah.
As if Johnny is reacting to something Zampano said, or, you know, so forth like that. This is also where we have footnotes that are astronomical symbols.
Yes.
These are, like, old alchemical symbols for planets. It's really fun because, like, they're related to the phrases that they're for. There's this game of, like, wordplay that all of this, by the way, is cited from an author named Hollander, who wrote a real book about echoes that this book cites.
Hollander, of course, being Holloway echoes.
Shut up. So
I can't. I'm an
there's
echo.
Like bits of wordplay involving calling out a phrase and then that phrase getting repeated, but only the last part of it as an echo would. So there's like one where about the muses and something about their inspirations, and then it returns something about their inspirations as if it's like a call and response. And that footnote is the symbol for Venus. There's also one that's very crass and is about Cicero and a donkey, an ass, and that one has Mars.
Which is funny.
There's one about, I believe, being buried underground, and that one has the symbol for Earth. And there's one about, like, what shall heal these wounds, the hours passing, and that has an infinity sign, which isn't space, but, you know, it's important.
It's time.
And what's fun about that is that the symbol he uses to represent the constant for echo is the symbol for the sun. Sunlight, vision, sun, echo. Echo, sun, S-U-N, S-O-N. Keep that in mind.
Put it on the corkboard.
Write that down in your copybooks now. So Echo being imprisoned, though, is important to the other central mythological figure, the Minotaur. The Minotaur is discussed a lot in this book, reluctantly, because Zampano has tried to block out and censor every mention of the Minotaur. This is represented by red, struck-through text. Like struck-through as if being an axe?
Yeah, that's something that we should briefly touch on, by the way. Much like how typeface is important, color is also generally important. Yeah. Anytime the word house comes up, even in other languages notably,
like maison,
or halls, it is blue. Mm-hmm. The word house is blue.
Yep.
I don't even know if it's ever acknowledged. I believe it's never acknowledged by the story itself. Mm-hmm. The house is just blue. Sometimes, you know what?
Sometimes the house is just
blue. Yeah, you know what, English teachers?
God damn it. You're on thin ice.
I'm actually in a guillotine for my ankles.
I know. Yeah, house is blue, Minotaur is red and struck through, as if bloodied. The Minotaur is, like, hinted at as a, like, spectral figure, with things like clanging of metal, and, like, Johnny keeps feeling like there's a cut on the back of his neck whenever he has one of those panic attacks. There's the growls from the house, and the beast that Holloway thinks he's found. All of these point to references to the Minotaur. Now, there is a chapter about the Minotaur where most of it is read and struck through, which is, again, a passage that Zampano tried to cover up that Johnny had to, like, painstakingly recover. This chapter is interesting because it is Zampano in defense of the Minotaur. Essentially, you know, the myth is that King Minos had his wife had sex with a bull, and the son was half bull, half human, and King Minos was so ashamed that he locked it up, imprisoned in a labyrinth beneath the castle. Now, it's really interesting because, for one thing, the part that Zampano starts about this, he's like, well, obviously a woman can't have sex with a bull. So there's another instance of him comparing science to fantasy. But he goes on about an interpretation that, like, it could have been that the Minotaur was a child with a birth defect, and Minos, being vain, hid the child away.
Yeah.
And then he talks about, like, a play that somebody wrote off of a... It's like Zampano wrote an article about the Minotaur, and then somebody wrote a play about it. And he recaps the play about his article about the Minotaur, which follows that story, where, like, the Minotaur is a child with a birth defect and is slain by a guy. Just like a jock.
A dude.
Like, yeah, he's like a dude bro. Theseus is just a dude bro. And it's really good, really touching. The idea of the Minotaur as both a, like, force that will kill you and a sympathetic figure is interesting. Like you said, compare that to the house in Anatomy.
Yeah.
Being a house that turns on you out of disarray.
Yeah, yeah. It's a force of nature that is constructed, but at the same time, like, you know, decidedly human still.
Yeah. The house, the Minotaur itself is... in a way, representation of just the trauma these people have, a specter of sorts. Or if not a trauma, just some element about themselves. Like, Holloway is so obsessed with being this, like, famous, successful person, and his belief in, like, force and commandment, or commandship, manifests as an actual target that he tries to kill but ends up getting himself killed. For Johnny, it's things about, like, being alone and memories of Raymond, the foster dad, and memories of his own father that start to trigger these panic attacks where he thinks he's getting attacked by the Minotaur. And, you know, for Navidson, it's like the Minotaur is deep within the house but forces him to go back because he has things he wants to confront, but he also wants to be with his family.
Yeah. To draw another parallel to anatomy, much like the basement, it's kind of like a representation of the deep pit of the psyche that we don't really want to contend lest it fully change us.
Yeah. So here's another thing, though. Johnny is scarred severely because when he was a child, Pelafina, his mother, accidentally spilled hot oil while cooking, and he, in her words, tried to catch it all. So he has scars going all up both his arms. Now, also remember the story at the end of a baby being born with a birth defect.
Yes.
This is where things get interesting. So
we start to have a little bit of a digital uninteractive media hypothesis here.
Sort of. I mean, that's a lot of this book. So essentially, every character, if we think of the three narrators as Zampano, Will Navidson, and Johnny Truant, they have a ton of similarities. For example, Navidson, his mom was a, like, I think they just say a Shakespearean, but that could be similarly like a poet, like a classically trained poet, like Pelafina. And as well, Navidson has his own sort of Pekingese in the form of Delisle. Delisle is a name Navidson mentions, and Karen thinks it's like an ex-girlfriend or someone he's cheating on her with. It turns out it was a photo he took of a kid about to get eaten by a vulture because the kid was starving. This is a reference to a real photo that somebody took of, like, the same thing, and the person went under heavy scrutiny for not helping her.
Yeah.
Navidson felt like he had a dangerous inability to act. Like, he was so guilt-ridden by this. And so to him, not taking care of the house is an inability to act.
Yeah.
He feels like it is something he needs to solve, or else he won't be able to sleep. It reminds him too much of Delisle.
I think it's another little bit that's sort of worth noting here is that this is brought up earlier with the friend that he made, who's in the wheelchair.
Reston.
Reston and him, I believe, became friends essentially after he took a picture of, that was Reston running away from an industrial accident.
Yeah.
And it's proudly framed on his you know, like, desk and stuff. And so it's something that's clearly, like, in the past and they're friends now. But, like, that sort of, you know, inability to act, that sort of, you know, trying to capture the moment over doing something is, like, present throughout the entire book.
Yeah. Like, it especially feels like Will could have alerted Reston, but instead he just kind of watched.
Yeah.
Additionally, by the way, so Will, he served in Vietnam. It's mentioned that, like, he was the subject of a photojournalist, and that's what got him into photojournalism. And additionally, Zampano, it's not directly stated he was in Vietnam, but he says he's killed many men, and he also has written extensively about the accuracy of Vietnam War era firearms that somebody was selling on, like, the newspaper, like, you know, for sale page.
Yeah, it's not too terrible of a jump to make.
Yeah. So, with that in mind, who wrote House of Leaves? And you might be thinking, oh, Mark Z. Danielewski. But in the fiction of House of Leaves, there are all these things that are kind of left up to interpretation, and there are a lot of, like, confusing overlaps. For example, like, Johnny could be a representation or, like, a projection of the child Zampano almost had. Why would Johnny be so aware of this story of this baby, what he just remembered, as he says, if not that actually being about Johnny? Like, Zampano, he has a lot of lines in the text about, like, a son, the Minotaur, that could be him working through the loss of his son who died due to a disability, or... So could Zampano actually be writing this and be just making up Johnny's stories? Because Johnny himself makes shit up.
Yeah.
You know? There's all the personal details of Johnny are made up. His last name isn't Truant. If anything, I think it's more of a Jon Snow scenario of, like, a child without a home. He's Truant.
Yeah.
Johnny is Truant.
It kind of feels like a nickname he came up for himself.
It's pretty good.
It's good.
It's pretty good.
Like, in terms of nicknames you can come up with for yourself, it's good.
Nom
I like
de plumes. And considering, like, no other details are given, there's no family names for anybody in Johnny's life. His boss isn't mentioned. All the girls he sleeps with, he only knows their first name.
If that.
If Thumper, that. Yeah, Thumper. Yeah. Or Lude doesn't have a family name. He's just Lude, L-U-D-E, though he is also L-E-W-D, if you know what I mean.
I don't. I can't spell. You know this.
And even then, like, I guess Navidson, in him being real or not, he's it's pretty heavily said, like, you know, this is a made-up movie, so Navidson's fake. But also at the same time, there are, like, the interviews from Karen and other things said by the characters that wouldn't exist if not for the movie, but are also included among, like it's not written materials. There's, like, images and photos that shouldn't exist if not for the movie being real.
Yeah.
Specifically the photos of the house, which are on the spine of the book. By the way, fun fact, the book, the pages are bigger than the binding on the front, so the book is bigger than the house.
Ah. Yeah.
So the question is, who wrote House of Leaves? You know, Navidson has this book. So, like, did he write it and he's reading his own copy of House of Leaves? Did Zampano write it? Did Johnny write it? The answer is Mark Z. Danielewski wrote it. Danielewski has said in interviews and other sort of testimonials or personal writings that much of House of Leaves is based off his family life. In the book, there one of the interviews Karen has is with a poet, but with a space between Poe and T. Poe made an album called Haunted, I believe, that references House of Leaves multiple times. He and his sister are very close together, and he said that much of House of Leaves was written after the death of their father. There, he also gave a story about how his father read like a book that Danielewski was writing and tore it to shreds. And then later his sister had taken the shreds out of the trash and tried to piece it together. Which fits like Johnny's process.
Yeah, it like the similarities there are practically screaming.
Yeah, but also their relationship with their father and then their father's death informs much of House of Leaves. It is a meditation from Danielewski on all these different aspects of being a family, as well as being meditations on academia and film and movie. And I think, like, I don't want to get too into his personal life, but I think it's really important to remember that this isn't an inexplicable, like, work of art that suddenly appeared. This is a work with authorship, and I think to me that makes the story even more meaningful. It's not nothing. There is, quote-unquote, intellectuals will deride postmodern art as being nothing and being meaningless. And when you talk about, like, Johnny being an unreliable narrator, there is, I think, a common urge to then write everything off as being, you know, hogwash. But this has very clear intention, and it is a very personal story being told through many different layers.
A brief bit that I remember from a Folding Ideas video that speaks to me currently is the point of a, like, abrupt ending. The point of, like, ending without closure is to make the audience sit and stir with whatever they've just witnessed. And it's like, I feel like that's very applicable in the sense of the point of bringing up an unreliable narrator, or the point of, you know, making a story that has these tons of conflicting elements, is not to sort of trick the reader, and it's not to make the reader assume that everything is just all 100% a lie. It is to get the reader to sit and think and stew over all of the individual details.
Right. And to me, like, comparing Johnny and Zampano and Will Navidson as being aspects of each other, thus then being also, like, inserts and aspects of Danielewski, I think brings a better cohesion to the story. all of these are telling the same story. They're not three separate tales being told.
Yeah.
A few, so that's like the big thesis statement. That's the end point. Slightly borrowed from Nightmind, don't worry about that. So,
speaking of Nightmind,
well, I wanted to go really quick into a bit of a handbook.
Yeah.
So, one thing to keep in mind that I couldn't really figure out where else to put is secret codes.
Ooh, yeah. Secrets.
So this book is labyrinthine, but it also has a lot of codes and Easter eggs in things that people have translated and talked about for years, literal decades. For example, in one of the Whalestone letters, Pelafina instructs Johnny to use an acrostic cipher where you take the first letter of a bunch of words that she will say in her next letter. That acrostic, that cipher appears in other parts of the book. Johnny will say things like, he'll just like ramble on words, and when you read the first letter, it gives a sentence like, a woman who loves my ironies, which is then mentioned by the band that he talks to, and he's like, wow, that took some really close reading to catch.
Yeah, a little bit of Mark Z. Danielewski patting himself on the back there, which I kind of love.
It's a really great. There's also like a footnote that is a bunch of photographers, and if you take the, it's photographers of darkness specifically. By the way, they're all real. Somebody made an album of examples of all their art.
Good lord.
Phenomenal.
That's interesting that they're all real, because in the book it specifically says that some of them aren't, I believe. Some of them are, quote, just made up, according to Johnny.
Maybe some of them aren't real, but a lot of them are.
Yeah.
Most of them. So, but like in this list, if you take the first letter of the family names of all the artists, you get a long list of visionaries, but with two O's missing, because they can't see. Also, if you take every footnote in the book and take the first letter, it spells out a few times Mark Z. Danielewski. God damn. There's also the Morse code chapter, SOS, has SOS baked into it a few times. It talks about how the actual shots in the movie are structured like an SOS. Three quick shots, three long cuts, three quick cuts. But then, like, in the footnotes, Johnny says fuck three times, and then fuck me, fuck this, fuck you, and then fuck three times, and that's an SOS of fucks. But then also, Johnny's paragraphs in the footnote are short or long, and they're divided with dots, which you can use to form Morse code for fuck. And then it happens again in a later footnote, and it spells out buttons. Because it's like a question, instead of SOS, it's so, and it's so buttons. Get it?
So, buttons, a needle pulling thread, la, a note to follow, so.
Yeah. The other big, like, not really cipher, but key, is in the collages of the book. There's a set of collages, by the way. There is a, like, guide to air ground relay codes and symbols for that. Like, so stuff I guess a pilot would use.
Yeah, it's much like there are like navy flags to specifically fly to, you know, indicate certain things. It's like symbols that are like, you know, an upper left corner and a bottom right corner that specifically mean this.
Yeah, and those appear a lot in the footnotes. Some of them are kind of jokes. Like for one of them, it's a German word that Johnny couldn't translate. Which, by the way, the only German girl he knew that could translate is the one that he was running from the boyfriend of.
Yeah.
He couldn't translate it, and the symbol for that is, like, do not understand, or need more information. There's also a mention of TNT, and that has the symbol for requires firearms, which is great. There's one about, like, a bridge, and he has the one for engineer needed. But the two most occurring ones are K and X. K is indicates direction to proceed, and that footnote, like the header for it, the pointer, appears many times throughout the book, usually in instances of confusion or some indication to like a direction. And the footnote itself is in chapter 9, and it's like the start of chapter 9, essentially. It's like Zampano talking about the history of the design of a labyrinth construction. X is do not proceed. It appears at a lot of very terminal-sounding lines, and the X footnote is the start of Chapter 9, like the actual header, where it is three quotes in Latin, which are like, something, I don't remember, and then it's like, the maze difficult to enter in the maze of no exit. So, do not proceed because you are at a dead end or you're stuck and you can't escape. Also, this one's really funny because that footnote itself has a footnote, but the second footnote is one where Johnny's butthole gets fingered. Yeah. So don't proceed. It warned you. Do not
proceed.
They warned you, buddy.
I just want to specifically say I like your saying of, like, do not proceed, much like you've hit a dead end, because there are moments that the footnote will essentially, like, refer you back to the footnote in chapter 9. The do not proceed footnote, which I imagine is sort of like, you know, going back to a familiar place and then, you know, trying a different path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The book really loops on itself in chapter 9 and becomes a labyrinthine effort of reading. I also want to point out the end of chapter 9 has, I believe that's when Navidson opens the door to find Jed and Wax. And there's a whole lot going on in that last sentence. There's a bit where, like, the footnote itself is a line in an angle that represents proceed to take off. This is Jed and Wax preparing to free. But also, that itself has the K, indicates direction to proceed. But also, the actual text for the footnote is like, there should not be punctuation here, editors. So, like, is that the start of chapter? Is that the start of the chapter with footnote K? Does it actually loop? Like, it's so perplexing and I love it. There's other things like that. Like, there's a check mark in the corner of a page. That's a reference to a letter where Pelafina says, like, if you received this letter and they didn't edit it, the weird, you know, new director, put a check mark on yours. And he does. And he does that in the book. And then there's also a few pages that have just a number on the left of the page. I know there's a 4 and a 12 with, like, a period. I couldn't find anything about those. I googled the page to see if anyone on, like, the House of Leaves forums had said anything about it. I don't know.
Did they perhaps go 4, 8, 15, 16? I don't remember the rest of the lost 4,
numbers. 8, 15, 16, 23, 42?
Okay, yes.
No.
Darn. Marcy Danielewski predicted lost?
That takes us to a good point, which is the aftermath and legacy of House of Leaves. Because House of Leaves has had a huge impact on society.
Yeah.
I think House of Leaves is not just a progenitor in sort of turning point in meta-modern fiction, but also in horror fiction. It is based off of Blair Witch and coincides with, like, found footage horror, which then becomes, like, Paranormal Activities and also Marble Hornets, which then gives way to a lot of internet and analog horror as a whole.
Yeah, web horror. I want to also shout out Control, which, like, has definite parallels with the house itself.
The oldest house. Yeah. And I think the stance that it takes as a modern haunted house is very common nowadays, like with Anatomy, where it is not a house haunted by spirits, but the house itself seems to have agency, or it responds directly to the people inside. I think Jacob Geller says, like, it's a house haunted by us.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah. There is a line in Anatomy that essentially, like, if we consider the house a being with anatomy, then what are we, the creatures that are foreign inside the house? We are parasites, you know, that the house will have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Monster House, by the way.
Yeah, I was about to say.
We've gone an entire episode without mentioning the Dan Harmon Rob Schraub masterpiece Monster House. I really wanted to say, when you were talking about the body parts of a house, you know, it's got a chandelier, which is the uvula.
Yep,
of course,
yep.
It's a girl house. There's no uvula mentioned for the house in this book. So the house at Ashtray Lane might be male or non-binary.
I'm going to say it's coded as male just because a big underlying theme is toxic masculinity.
Ah, yeah.
Ah.
Ah.
It's a toxically masculine house. I'm willing to bet if they started communicating with it, it'd be like, have you heard of Andrew Tate?
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you tried this new all meat diet?
I also want to point to the liminal movement in the back rooms, because House of Leaves and a lot of modern haunted house stuff relies on the uncanny difference between what a house is and what it isn't, in like the absence of living. The house at Ashtree Lane, the hallway and all the stuff between it, has nothing. In fact, it excises any evidence that there was life. Any objects or food left disappear. You know, the fishing line breaks, the paint goes away, the food is ruined and often just disappears and goes wherever, evaporates. It leaves no trace. And I think that is present in things like the back rooms, where it is a room with no furniture, no windows, no exit. It's like the turning on its head of a common space into something utterly hostile, but it's hostile because what makes it so like homey and warming isn't there.
Yeah.
The stuff we put in the house is often more of a signifier or determiner of the purpose of the house than the building itself.
I would actually like to contrast with the back rooms a little bit here as well. Just to say that, like, I think the an interesting key detail between the two is that while the back rooms and a lot of liminal horror, the horror of House of Leaves or An Anatomy or A Haunting of Hill House is the familiar, like, the familiar homestead being warped. Backrooms, like Backrooms and other liminal horror projects, the familiar in that instance is usually thing like places that you shouldn't dwell on. It's malls, it's, you know, it's dead malls, it's office spaces. Like the uncanny horror there is usually these should be populated by people going about their day, whereas the house itself is more this should be populated by people who are living inside this house.
I'll give you that for liminal spaces in general, but not the back rooms. Because, like, the original back rooms, the canon back rooms, is, like, wallpaper that's slightly water damaged and carpet. Mm. And I always interpreted that as, like, a house without furniture being moved into or moved out of.
Fair enough. I always interpreted that as, like, a off-beige, like, office space sort of thing.
Shitty office space.
Most office spaces are. Have you been to any? They suck.
I've seen the movie. Yeah. Also, I think House of Leaves also, it, like, we talked about how prescient it is, but it's very early, like, unfiction. Like, it is debatably real with references to other media that don't exist, and it battles its authenticity, trying to, like, purport its authenticity while also not. It rewards looking things up in, like, there's a lot of metatextual references. For example, I have a poem by Rainer Maria Rilke that is referenced multiple times throughout the book, which I would like to read really quick because it's very important. A ghost, though invisible, still is like a place. Your sight can knock on, echoing, but here, within this thick black pelt, your strongest gaze will be absorbed and utterly disappear. Just as a raving madman, when nothing else can ease him, charges into his dark night howling, pounds on the padded wall, and feels the rage being taken in and pacified. She seems to hide all looks that have ever fallen into her, so that, like an audience, she can look them over, menacing and sullen, and curl to sleep with them, but all at once. As if awakened, she turns her face to yours, and with a shock, you see yourself, tiny, inside the golden amber of her eyeballs, suspended like a prehistoric fly. That is The Black Cat by Rainer Maria Rilke. So that just is a summary of the book.
Yeah.
Like that.
Why did we just spend an entire fucking, like, almost 2 hours summarizing the book? We could have just read that.
But that is never said in full. You have to, like, find that poem yourself. And there's so many elements of that that feel... It's like there's metatextuality in something like Ulysses that references the Odyssey, and it's like, oh, it's the Odyssey. But the sheer variety of the things in House of Leaves, and like the fact that it gives you the names of some of them, like with the Hollander book, like makes it feel similar to looking up like another channel on Catastrophe Crow, you know?
Yeah, that's like... I want to shout out as well, like, the ARG aspect.
Yeah.
That, like, I mean,
it's not an ARG.
But... It's not an ARG, but the, like, puzzle-solving aspect of the, like you said, a lot of the, you know, first letters ultimately spelling out different sentences and finding the like the codes that are like the ships or the planes or whatever it was, I believe were not in the original version. Because a lot of the stuff after the appendix was not in, like, the first edition. And so, if you were to see that originally, you would have to look up those codes.
I think it's just the Whalestone letters that weren't in the first version.
Oh.
And I believe there are still some letters that aren't in House of Leaves that are in the Whalestone letters, the, like, separate published novella.
Oh, okay.
That was released afterwards as supplementary material, and then later added to the re-release.
The point being, ultimately, that, like, while I am also not a fan of, like, broadening the term of ARG, because ARG is something pretty specific, the aspect of, like, decoding and, you know, theorizing and, like, finding the little clues hidden in the text itself, going back and, you know, rereading certain things with a different light, is something that is a lot more popular nowadays with a lot of web series and web fiction and alternate reality games. Marble Hornets, of course, like you said, is already worth
Petscop was one that really used metatextual references that weren't parts of the game, but just things to look at.
Yep.
Was really big. Yeah.
Yeah. It's...
Forgive me for this. I'm going to commit a sin.
Oh, no.
This is also a big part of why I liked Homestuck.
Ah, dang it. We've gone so many episodes without saying the word.
Look, hear me out. Homestuck was another thing that really utilized its medium in things like font choice, page layout, composition, like to its extreme, also filled with metatext. Also, so much of Danielewski, the way he writes characters and their voice, is written in a way that feels more chat roomy, at least with Johnny.
Yeah.
Like Johnny will do things like write 3 question marks in a row.
I was literally like, a part that I wanted to get to of this was to ask, is Johnny Truant a Dave like?
Yeah. Yep. I would say Johnny is a Dave like.
He really is.
I mean, he doesn't have the like no punctuation or no capitalization that Dave likes tend to have, but he is, I think, still on the Dave like scale.
He's on the Dave spectrum.
Yeah.
The Dave mention.
Yeah. He's not Juice from 17776, which I feel like is the closest to Dave that's not Dave.
Yeah.
Closer to Shinji from Paradise Killer.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's still very Dave-like.
But yeah, now honestly, like, as somebody who was also a Homestuck fan, I 100% understand what you mean.
Yeah.
Of, like, how it specifically twists and uses the medium to its full extent.
House of Leaves is just so, like, in my current reread, I've been going very much in detail and trying to do as much. I've been trying to 100% House of Leaves. People say you can't 100% a book. Bitch, try reading this. But I haven't even gotten to, in my reread, like, the Pelican poems and the fragments, which are just passages. There's so much in the book that doesn't immediately follow the realms of a book, but is part of the book because it is printed and bound within the same pages. House of Leaves, by the way, could refer to a book. Leaves of Paper.
Yep. Leaves of Paper.
Yes.
House of Leaves. This is actually something that I was wanting to bring up, too, is just specifically how, like, we've mentioned it so many times, but just to put a specific point on it, the book itself is the house. At the very least, that's, I think, one reading you can specifically have. It's like, as you mentioned, like, there's the part where a hole is torn through and the page ends up having a block that is, like, literally, you know, like, showing the text on the other page.
Right. Or when Navidson goes through a cramped passageway, the text becomes cramped.
Yeah. Like, the house itself, part of the beauty of this book is that the, like, winding corridors, the, you know, plot threads that don't ever seem to resolve, like, all of that seems explicitly, or at least implicitly, meant to emulate the feeling of Navidson themselves, like, Navidson actually going through this house, or the, you know, the feeling of the family living in this forever expanding strange world. And, like, man, is that cool. It's a really exceptional idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also, so you know, the book House of Leaves is a house of leaves of pages in which there is a manuscript about a movie, and that manuscript is inside a trunk which houses those pieces. So you can go down. So we have the book, pages, you know, Johnny, trunk, manuscript, movie, book, because Will Davidson reads House of Leaves. Because
Will Davidson reads this fucking
book. It's an infinite loop of recursion. It keeps going down.
It echoes forever.
Ah, God. It's so great. It's an infinity echo chamber. It's a goddamn echo chamber. Get out of your echo chambers, liberals. Liberal feminists.
Liberal feminists.
Oh, it's too good. House of Leaves, beautiful. By the way, when I first read this, I was like, man, the Davidson records gotta suck, because so much of that's just darkness. But you know what? Now, I've changed my mind, and you'll figure out why in a few weeks.
Oh, yeah, no, don't worry. I'm excited to get this theme month done, not only because we're gonna save our feet, but also because we've got some real fucking bangers coming up as well.
Hey, I just went out to get a snack. Did I miss anything?
Oh, wow. How long have you been out?
I think it was just a few minutes. Not more than six.
Wait a minute. 6 minutes? But we haven't heard from you since the beginning. It's been like 2 hours. I think we need to get a refund on this house.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not having a good time here. Alright. So that's Surfer Pro for this week for the start of Spooky Month House of Leaves. Housetober. It's Housetober, everyone. Thanks for listening. You can follow us on any podcasting platform you like at NetSurfer Pro. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review, let us know how we're doing, let us know what you think we should cover next. You can also follow us on Twitter at NetSurfer Pro, where we post updates and hints. I have some hints for the rest of Housetober if you want to figure it out. Try to follow the clues, you know, follow the ciphers, the codes, just like Johnny's codes. Follow the codes.
Yes, if you put the first word that we've said from every single sentence together, you'll actually get a Caesar cipher you can solve that'll take you to a YouTube video of us reading out this episode.
And if you run that through a spectrogram,
then you can find the links to Matthew Marissa's stuff.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/twack, where I stream some weekdays. It's been a little rocky recently, but I'm trying to improve at that. I stream usually between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. Central Time. I've been streaming some single-player games. I'm just about finished up Pikmin 4, which was really fun. I'll probably do some more pinball streams soon and finish up Cruelty Squad. And then I'm also planning on playing Pizza Tower next.
Nice.
And since it's spooky month, you might find a spooky stream or two.
Ooh.
Perhaps. You know, last year I streamed Yume Nikki. I don't know if I'm going to do another RPG Maker horror game, but I've got something in mind.
Ooh.
So you can follow me there. That's where you can support me financially. You can also follow me on Twitter at Twackaroo. And you can follow me on YouTube at Twack.
Nice.
And also my VODs channel, Twacks, VODs, and Ends.
Which is a very good name.
For if you miss a stream.
As for myself, you can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, where I actually have a video up. It's a very short one, but it's up. It's a video.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't tell anyone. Anyway, you can find me on TikTok and on Twitter at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWILS0N. I post my hot takes and videos of my cat. I've been doing more sort of, you know, analyses stuff and whatnot on TikTok, short form talking about stuff content. And you can also find me on Twitch at Machine Gun Vampire, where I might be streaming one of these days. You never know. I never know. But aside from that, we've been NetSurfer Pro, and I'd say that we'll see you next time, but I guess we're going to be stuck here until the next episode.
You'll have roughly 20 more days or so.
Ah, man. Can you at least, like, I don't know, bring us, you know, food and stuff? Can we order DoorDash?
I mean, maybe not DoorDash, but I could, like, give you some, like, turkey legs.
Yeah, that probably works.
I mean, just food. I could give you food. Not anything related to any specific thing. You know what? I've said too much. Bye!